argument this morning is International Production Specialist versus Schwing American Incorporated. Mr. Dunn.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Dunn.
My name is Michael Dunn, and I represent the appellant in this case, International Production Specialist, Inc. I'll refer to the appellant as IPS. The appellee is Schwing American Incorporated. I will, for simplification, refer to that as Schwing. I'm going to focus on three rulings by the trial court that I believe necessitate reversal. The first ruling deals with the determination that Schwing was justified in terminating the party's contract. The second ruling was the court's ruling that an award of silo installation costs was incidental damages under the party's contract and the breach by IPS. The third was issue that I'm going to address is the award of silo interior recoating costs as incidental damages. Each of these rulings should be reversed because for two reasons. First, the trial court failed to properly apply the controlling law governing the resolution of these issues. Secondly, when you apply the proper law, there was a failure of proof by Schwing to justify the relief that was accorded to it. With respect to the contract termination issue, the trial court ruled that Schwing was justified in terminating the contract because it had proved that IPS had materially breached the contract. That is not enough under Wisconsin law. Under Wisconsin law, to excuse a non-breaching party from performance, the non-breaching party must not only show that there was a material breach, but must also show that the breach that occurred was so substantial as to destroy the essential objects of the contract. The trial court did not make any finding with respect to that aspect of the law, and Schwing did not attempt to provide any evidence to establish that there had been an essential destruction of the objects of the contract. All that Schwing introduced at trial in terms of impact from the defaults that it alleged was that it had incurred increased costs to install silos, two wet sludge storage silos that had been provided by IPS. But even as to that issue, the Schwing witness who testified as to damages, Nancy Pradach, was unable to quantify what that cost was. Then you layer over that inability to really identify a monetary impact, the fact that the record made clear that at the time that the contract was terminated in February of 2005, the contract required five silos to be assembled. Four of them had been completed. The two largest ones, the wet storage silos, had been completed approximately 2 weeks before the termination of the contract. The only silo that remained to be completed was a granulate storage bin, which was the smallest of all the five silos. In addition to that fact, David Miller, a contractor who was hired by Schwing to go out to the site and to take a look at the status of the project, he testified that he was there in January of 2005 for a two-week period. And he testified that when he left the project in mid-January, he felt the project was getting back on track, that he had a realistic schedule of completion to take and present to the owner of the project. Schwing provided no evidence that there was ever any change of that circumstance, that there was ever any further backsliding or further delays. And so what you have is on February 11th, when it terminates the contract, it's doing so because of historical breaches that have essentially been cured, as evidenced by the testimony of their own representative. With respect to the silo installation costs, the trial court held IPS accountable for $120,300 of silo installation costs, reasoning that it was incidental to IPS's delayed performance. In order for that cost to be a cost to be borne by IPS, IPS had to have had a contractual obligation to install silos at the Zion site. This contract, when it was originally executed back in 2001, was to be performed at Waukegan site. The record is clear that the project at Waukegan compared to the project at Zion, was much simpler. The Zion site was a full-blown construction project, had multiple complexities that simply did not exist at the Waukegan site.
You know, forgive me, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment, Mr. Dunn. The new subcontractor that took over took 5 weeks to complete that project, right?
To finish the last silo, right. Correct. Well, 5 weeks from when it was hired, correct.
Right. Do we know if IPS could have done that faster?
My client testified that it would have been easily able to meet that requirement. My client's position at the trial was that you gave us an unrealistic performance criteria because instead of giving us a work area that would have enabled us to work on all five silos at one time, you gave us a work area that everybody agreed limited us to working on only two silos at a time. So the first two silos had to be completed. That was the truck receiving bins. They were installed in mid-September. The next task was to do the wet sludge storage silos. Those were the largest silos, 46 feet tall, 23 feet in diameter. That's a major undertaking, and it took my client approximately three and a half months to accomplish that. Now,
speaking of 3.5 months to accomplish, if the deadline schedules in the layout, if the deadlines in the layout schedules schedule were not binding on IPS, what deadlines were? In other words, it isn't possible that there were no deadline requirements at all, is it?
No, that's correct. The law says that if you don't have a contractually specified deadline, then it's a reasonable time period. And in order to determine that, you have to look at all the circumstances. You have to look at issues such as weather delays. You have to look at the very work area that has been provided to the contractor to work under. And you have to look at a whole slew of these factors to determine whether or not you've had reasonable period of time to perform. None of that was addressed in before the trial court.
But the trial court did look at that layout schedule, and under Wisconsin law, there was nothing inappropriate, was it, for the court to look at that schedule and use that as a basis to try to determine the reasonable delivery time?
No, I disagree with that. And that the reason for that is because you have to look at when that layout schedule was prepared. I believe it was prepared in March of 2004, before any progress had started. These projects, as this case shows, they're complex. There are all kinds of things that happen that result in rethinking things, rescheduling deadlines, and all of that type of situation. What was missing in this case was any testimony from any representative of the owner that it felt that IPS was tardy in performing. Instead, it was Schwing saying for its self-serving purposes, yes, you were tardy in performing because you did not meet this layout schedule. But no showing that layout schedule continued to have any vitality as the project went along. And my client testified that it was sitting in on meetings that Schwing asked it to be Schwing's representative at meetings at the owners, and that the owners were telling him, you're okay. There are things that are happening in the project that don't necessitate you to install the silos until a later date. My client testified, and there was no rebuttal evidence, that there was an agreement with the owner that we would install the silos, the two wet storage sludge silos, in February of 2005. They were on transports ready to be installed by that date. My client met that request from the owner, and there was no testimony to the contrary. And so when you get down to the reasonableness time period, there hasn't been any showing that what my client did really had any major or significant impact on the project.
But there didn't the court also take into account promises that IPS made that the work would be done in 2 weeks, and those deadlines came and passed, and there was still no progress? The court took that into account, too.
It did, but if you look at that testimony by the Schwing witnesses, they said that basically from the start, IPS was promising for a 4 to 5 month period it'll be done in two weeks. If we backtrack that time period from February going back, that would mean that basically IPS was promising that it was going to have the whole project done by the middle of October, which was not a realistic deadline, even under the classic layout schedule.
Well, you know, part of your defense to the breach claim appears to be that the deadline dates were unrealistic, right?
Well, we argued that they were unrealistic and that was, therefore, we weren't in breach.
But is that a valid defense to a breach of contract? In other words, wouldn't it be your responsibility not to sign a contract that has unrealistic dates?
But we in this contract put in a clause that said we will not be held liable, responsible for unrealistic deadlines because we were over a barrel. Schwing was threatening to sue us if we didn't sign a contract. My client was looking at either getting sued or trying to make the best of a bad situation. It negotiated into the contract a clause that said we're not to be held responsible for unrealistic deadlines. And so the question is, was it realistic to expect us to have this done by December? But then take it the next step and say, what was the ramification of us not meeting that deadline? And there was no demonstration that it had any significant impact on the overall project.
Mr. Dunn, damages aside for just a moment, with regard to layout schedule, was there any testimony presented as to custom and usage in the construction of such silos, that is industry-wide, that when there are modifications, which I'm sure inevitably occur in the course of construction, that there's a need to make notations of the change? And I mean, in other words, as these discussions, you say, ensued regarding recognition of changed circumstances, were they all just a verbal exchanges and felt there was no need to make notations to, you know, just recognize the change?
What my client testified to was that there were regular meetings
right.
with the project
right.
owner. And
at
those meetings, which would have been documented by the project owner, the status of the case. There was no evidence presented at the trial of any of those notes from the project owner. But there was the testimony of my client saying that there were these regular meetings and that the regular meetings, that there was always an agreement as to how the project was proceeding and not a disagreement.
Well, if the project owner was in possession of that documentation, was that accessible to you, I mean, by discovery? I'm just trying to see how...
Yes, it would have been accessible to me by discovery as well as to the plaintiff.
But wouldn't that have further buttressed your position that there was a recognition of this of these changed circumstances?
Yes. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt.
Good morning. John Schmidt from Briggs & Morgan, along with Jeff Shaw for Schwing of America, Inc. Your Honor, it's important to remember the scope that this case has to be reviewed in. Chief Judge Randa had a two-day bench trial, made numerous findings of fact, answered questions, mixed questions of fact and law, awarded damages, and made credibility determinations. These are all clearly erroneous, reviewed as clearly erroneous on appeal. Now, the appellant would like to retry this entire case to the court, but when there are two findings of fact that could be supported and that the trial judge chooses one, that doesn't amount to a clear error.
When Schwing terminated the contract, four of the five silos had been assembled, and the two wet sludge storage silos had been sitting on transports for 2 weeks waiting to be installed. Schwing's own project manager said that the project was back on track. Isn't that an odd time to terminate?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is. There was four that were ready, but three had yet to be installed. There was a lot of back and forth with Schwing and IPS in terms of when would the silos actually be installed. IPS continually asserted to be ready in 2 weeks. Schwing heard that mantra for a number of weeks in a row. At one point, IPS said it will be ready to be delivered and installed in December. That date came and went. I believe it was December 20th, 2004. Again, date came and went, and there was no installation. IPS then said, well, it'll be on transports and ready to go in January. Well, the January dates came and went, and it wasn't delivered yet. It wasn't being installed. The thing that actually broke the camel's back in this case is in February of 2004, IPS demanded more money and more time to get the work done. At that point, there had already been an agreement as to the change orders and what the terms of the contract were, what the price of the contract was, but they're demanding more money again to get the work done.
Well, because that timeline was always shifting, it really is a little unclear to me how, or I guess what, you considered the deadline for performance that IPS failed to meet here. In other words, as of the date of termination, which was February 11th, right?
That's correct.
How late was IPS?
At that point, IPS was well beyond what the deadlines were in the layout schedule.
How late was IPS?
I believe that was, I believe, and I'm not exactly certain, was 3 months, if not more, from the layout schedule. But it was certainly well beyond what they said would be ready and delivered and assembled in December.
And how did the delay really alter the essential object of the contract?
Well, Your Honor, as to the delay, materially breached the contract because the work site was a continuing progress. It wasn't just waiting for IPS's silos to be delivered and installed. The work at the site had to continue. And so as they were waiting for IPS to deliver and assemble, the rest of the wastewater treatment plant was being built. With that, there was timelines that need to be met in order to keep on track with the entire project. So the costs increased because cranes were needed to install the silos, to lift them over what was already built, to get them into the spots that they needed to be.
But weren't all of these sort of approximate deadlines?
Your Honor, our position is that the layout schedule is a part of the contract.
No, I know that, but I know, I mean, I understand what your point is, but let's say the contract only established approximate deadlines. Can there be a breach of contract for failure to meet those deadlines if they're approximate?
Certainly. There's still, even if they were approximate deadlines and the layout schedule was not a part of the contract, there still needs to be performance, as the appellant has said, within a reasonable time. With Schwing continually asking, when are you going to perform, and IPS continually saying 2 weeks, at some point it becomes unreasonable. And that had gone on for a number of months. And with the final demand of more money to install and to perform the work that they agreed to do in July of 2004 when the change orders and purchase order became the contract of the parties. By the time it reached that date, it was unreasonable at that point, especially with the work that had reached the termination date.
Which date? February 11th?
Right. By the time it had reached the date that they had demanded more money to perform the work that they agreed to do.
Is that February 11th?
I believe that is February 3rd. I can find that out.
Don't waste time doing that. I can look.
It was February 3rd when they demanded more money. February 11th was when the contract was actually terminated.
Mr. Schmidt, you speak of the demand for increased monies late in the project. Was any of that the result of what Mr. Dunn has suggested were these agreements at the meetings to, in effect, modify the layout schedule?
I don't know that there's any evidence of that was the result of the increased costs that they were seeking. From what Schwing could tell, we had a contract. It was for a dollar certain. I was to install the silos and to deliver the silos to paint. And
so these meetings that Mr. Dunn referenced that are in the trial came out during the trial. Spoke only to extensions by the project owner to a timeline, but didn't speak to any modifications which could justify cost increases.
That's correct. That's right. After failing to perform for all this time and then demanding more money at the having already been late, Chewing just had enough and needed to get the work done.
How much of these delays, as we speak of them, were agreed upon at these meetings?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I don't know that the evidence.
You say that they keep falling behind, but were you agreeing to an extended timeline? I guess is what I'm really asking.
No, Your Honor, I don't think.
Look back, as you asked the district judge, to the sweep of the delay that ensued in this project. I guess my point is what part of that delay was not agreed to by the project owner?
I think the delays from the original layout schedule and the delays from what IPS said it would do in General Note Number 1, that it'd be done on September 1st or 30th with a lot of these the work. As soon as it passed those deadlines, it was late. I don't know that there are any agreements made to extend those deadlines out. Schwing knew that IPS was supposedly doing the work and getting the work done, and so it made sense when they said it'll be ready in 2 weeks to give them the 2 weeks to try to get it done in order to perform. As we're getting into, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I wanted you to speak to that, and how many two-week extensions were they given?
The testimony from Nancy Predash, I believe, said there were several. I don't think she had a specific number. I think she said it went on for several months.
You know, there's an argument that really gave me some pause, and it's the substandard work argument. Why wasn't Chewing bound by the warranty clause, which required Chewing to give IPS a chance to remedy any faulty workmanship? I know that your argument is that this was raised on appeal for the first time, and so it's waived. But I'd like to explore it a bit. I do wonder why you weren't required to give them the first shot at correcting defects.
Well, putting aside the waiver of the argument, there's a few reasons why the warranty wouldn't apply. The first, as Chief Judge Randa found, is that you don't need to go back to the breaching party who materially breached the contract and ask them to perform again. At this point, they have proven that they were not going to perform. They had materially delayed on a number of occasions, and there is no suggestion that they're actually going to get the work done in time. So with all of those factors under the Steele case, you don't have to ask the materially breaching party to perform one more time. There's a few other reasons. One, the warranty says it's effective from 1 year after acceptance. Now, IPS never actually delivered. It was because they were materially delaying the project and not performing. So because it was never actually delivered, the warranty clause isn't triggered. They had never actually accepted. I'm sorry. The warranty clause was never triggered. So that's another reason why the warranty doesn't apply. The final reason was the contract was terminated. This was part of the purchase order, and because of the material delays, the contract was terminated. So under that theory as well, the warranty wouldn't apply. But again, our initial position is that theory has been waived.
Getting back to the one of the points Mr. Dunn made for a moment, can you address this argument that the whole delay process really occurred because they couldn't work on all the silos at one time, that you required that they just do the first two and then do the next two? You want to address that?
Sure. There were IPS was aware of the schedule going into it. They knew from the original purchase order that on a construction project like this, there's going to be a number of steps that need to be done. You can't finish and install one of the main silos that's required to be installed towards the end of the project. You have to go along as the project progresses. So they knew this entering the project that it was going to take various steps along the way. Something that the appellant had raised in terms of the layout on the project, they were aware of that as well. They went out and inspected the site and agreed to perform at the Zion site. That's what the final change order did, was to agree that this will take place at Zion. The trial judge heard both of those arguments and chose that, found that we were correct in that, and that doesn't amount to clear air. They also had their own site that they were building on the silos as well, so they had that they could be working on the later silos that would be installed at a later date. There's just one other point I'd like to address. It's the point the essential objects must be destroyed in order to cause a breach. I don't think that's the correct standard. That's the standard that's been used in rescission cases where the parties are seeking to call off the entire agreement. This isn't that case. They're seeking to Schwing has asked for damages and was awarded damages. They weren't seeking to call off the entire contract. And the other point to that is the case that they raised in their reply brief, the computer management case, also said that the defendant was entitled to damages in that case, and therefore the rescission wasn't proper. Unless the court has any other questions?
Apparently not.
Thank you,
Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Dunn.
Thank you. Just briefly touch on a couple of issues. I think the statement that Wisconsin law does not require a destruction of the essential objects of the contract not being law is incorrect, that it's only limited to rescission cases. The computer management cases is not a rescission case. It was a contract termination case. And what the court in that case, the Supreme Court, ruled is that the non-breaching party, in fact, did not have any justification to terminate that contract because it had failed to show that the breach by the breaching party destroyed the essential objects. That is exactly what we're dealing with in this case.
Do you agree with Schwing's assessment that the court can affirm the damages in the amount of $100,584 without any further analysis if it finds a breach of contract?
No, and that is because the warranty claim issue that we raise is much broader than just simply the interior recoating cost. That would also apply to the defective workmanship claim that they allege with respect to the granulate storage silo. And then in addition to that, we argued primarily that if Schwing did not have a right to terminate the contract, it's not entitled to any damages at all. So that's the threshold issue that has to be surmounted. Once beyond that, then you get these issues regarding was the silo installation cost proper, were the interior recoating cost proper, and then the warranty issue. And so then on top of that, you have the court failed to give us a $46,114 credit for the unpaid balance of the contract price that they never paid to that. Under the law, they're entitled to put in the position they would have been had the contract been formed, not to be enhanced. By not crediting that against the damage that were awarded, the court put Schwing in a better position than what it would have been in had the contract been performed.
Bottom line, what do you think you lost?
What do I think we lost? Mm-hmm. We lost $465,000 plus $59,000 of additional work we did to assist Schwing in discharging their responsibility to install the silos. We did not have a responsibility at the Zion site to install silos.
No, I guess my question is, in terms of this credit, this not crediting the unpaid balance from the August 04 change order, there's no Wisconsin case law that says it was error for the court to make that kind of calculation.
Well, there is, because the Wisconsin law says you have the rule is to put the party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. Had the contract been performed, they would have had to pay $46,114. Therefore, since they didn't since the contract was not completed, you have to deduct that from the damages that are awarded. Otherwise, Schwing gets a windfall because it's being reimbursed for the monies it paid to complete the contract. And then on top of it, it's saving $46,114 that it never paid to IPS. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the